Merci beaucoup, Philippe. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and deliver the lecture. Maybe we should get our lights down. Should I do that? Okay, it's going on. So I'd like to start my talks by reminding you that you can think, that we do think about our intestinal microbiota as a neglected organ, which has a major role in health and disease. And I show a list of diseases, which is actually incomplete, and it's in French, so in tribute to this place, not many other slides will be in French. There are a number of diseases where perturbations of gut microbiota are suspected to play a role in a chronic disease. In addition, chronic diseases, as you know, increase steadily in industrialized countries. And basically, there is no prevention because they are not detected soon enough. And there is no cure because when they are detected, alterations are in general so advanced that they are irreversible. So facing that, we thought that if we were to address the issue of prevention, one can think about prevention as risk detection and risk alleviation. And we wondered whether the neglected organ can inform on a risk of chronic disease and can be target for intervention then. The challenge, of course, was how to assess the state of the neglected organ in each and every individual. And in the MetaHit, we decided to tackle this challenge by describing the overall composition of the gut microbes by constructing a reference gene catalog for all the genes that humans can carry, and then develop what we call quantitative metagenomic pipeline for gene profiling. You can assess the state of the other genome as it came to be known of an individual. The reference gene catalog we established already 4 years ago, 3.3 million genes, 150-fold more than the human genome. And the catalog did represent 12 individuals basically across the world. Since then, we have improved the catalog, of course, by redefining a little better the genes. It's a complex process to define a gene in such a very complex community. And a new catalog should be coming out, actually containing about 10 million genes. Very briefly, what one can notice, this catalog, which is constructed with about 10 times more individuals than the first one, contains more genes, is that the genes which are kind of found in most or high fraction of individuals, say about 5%, are basically saturating. There are slightly over 3 million of these genes, while genes which are rare, which are kind of associated with individuals, still increase, which is interesting and challenging. But we think that in terms of addressing problems of common disease, these common genes are most important. And they have been, I think, captured by and large almost totally. So what is quantitative metagenomics? Quantitative metagenomics is a process where we go from stool sample all the way to different prediction models, which can be of interest for clinicians. We have developed in collaboration with a startup company, Enteron, a simple way and standard robust way to collect stool samples, which can now be collected at patients' homes and sent by mail without alteration of composition. And then From these two samples, total DNA is extracted that gives access to each and every gene in a sample, thus in an individual, and sequenced to a high extent, 30 to 50 million sequences, which capture presence and abundance of each gene. Abundant genes are sequenced often, and rare genes are not sequenced that often. And then to deconvolute that the sequences are short and not informative on their own, they're mapped on a catalog gene, which contains genes that we defined from metagenomic studies, but also genes from known genomes. Mapping each time when a read, sequencing read, is mapped non-ambiguously to a gene is counted, so we get gene counts for 3, 4, 10 million genes for each individual. We call them gene profiles, and after some informatics tricks, we correlate these gene counts to human data and thus identify relevant microbial players, build and test prediction models. Standardization is critical for this process. I'll show you an example of that. Beyond describing all the genes of the catalog, well, it's very challenging for statisticians to work with millions of objects and try to decide which one is associated robustly with a phenotype. Say, we have decided to cluster genes into what we call metagenomic units, which are really support of the genes. Genes live in genomes. They just don't float around on their own. And very clearly and simply, all genes of a species have to have the same frequency in an individual. Well, they're like on a necklace. If I see a green bead, I know that all the other green beads have to be there and at the same frequency. Now, the species abundance varies very greatly across individuals. That's illustrated for almost 60 species that we found in over 90% of individuals. The variations of abundance across individuals is several logs. So that works very well, and we can bin the genes very efficiently. And then we represent a species by kind of a barcode. So here, there are 7 species. We display 50 genes per species and have a kind of color code heat map for these genes. So you can see here several hundred individuals, each column is an individual. You can see that genes from species tend to be, from these particular species, tend to be in individuals which are here on the right and not in, or less so in individuals that are at the left. So we have clustered genes in almost 7,000 different metagenomic units. About 740 or large have over 700 genes, where we look at the distribution of metagenomic species across in function of size. We see low abundance of species at around 700 genes. And when we look at the presence of essential genes required for life of bacteria, we see that essential genes are basically in these large metagenomic units, which we call metagenomic species. They correspond to bacterial species. 85% of them were previously unknown. But we also define different MGUs, which correspond to phages, plasmids, CRISPR elements, and that's displayed here when we project phage genes. We found phage genes in these small units. And then we can also construct networks of dependencies of different units and describe in detail composition of human microbiota. This is one example, different small metagenomic units which depend on a large metagenomic unit, and there are phages, there are CRISPR elements, and we even see that when CRISPR elements are there, then a particular phage is not present because these CRISPR elements defend against that phage. So we have a description of this space in detail, but also we can simplify analysis a lot because here This happens to be a 4 million gene catalog, an intermediary version. We have simplified it to about 8,000 or maybe 800 of metagenomic species. So now we are in position to assess microbiome in each and every individual. We think about quantitative metagenomics as a powerful microscope to scan this neglected organ. This happens to be the first microscope ever invented by Antony von Leeuwenhoek. Now we have these powerful molecular scanners for this gene. So what can we do with this? Well, we can try to diagnose patients. And to start that, I'll remind you that human genome markers are not so very good for, say, a chronic disease like obesity to discriminate between lean and obese people. This is shown in a rock analysis. Output of the rock analysis is area under curve. If we can't really discriminate, then we have as many chances to be wrong as to be right, and then our curve is really a diagonal. Area under curve is 0.5. If we can perfectly discriminate the phenotype, then our area under curve is 1. We never have any false detection, and we have very high power of discrimination. For 32 validated obesity risk loci, AUC is 0.58, which is barely better than random. So how do we do with metagenomic biomarkers with our MGS? The output of area under curve for lean and obese in function of number of metagenomic species that we use is displayed here. We get, for say, 10 to 12 features, 10 to 12 metagenomic species, an area under curve which is about 0.78, which is much better than 0.58 for human genome markers. It's not yet spectacular, but it's much better. Now, at present, since 2010, there are 97 human genome markers identified as associated with BMI. Collectively, they explain 2.7% of the variance of BMI, which is not very much. With MGS, we explain significantly more. A similar kind of message one gets when one looks at type 2 diabetes. Once again, human genome markers give an AUC comparable to that for lean obese, 0.6, and metagenomic markers give an AUC 0.84 in a study with a Chinese cohort, and a similar study in Sweden gives similar kind of AUC. A study on liver cirrhosis, just to give a further illustration, how well can we diagnose patients that have liver cirrhosis. A study is done in China, 123 patients, 114 controls, split in discovery cohort, where algorithm is trained to give an AUC of 0.95. In a validation cohort, we get a little better than that. Now it's slightly out of date, but it's quite good with only 7 metagenomic species. So we do conclude that human metagenome biomarkers have better discriminatory value than human genome biomarkers in several chronic diseases. We think this should be explored vigorously. Can we do more? Once we have found who is sick and who is not, we can try to monitor the patients, and this is described in ulcerative colitis MetaHit study under responsibility of Francisco Guarner. I was very pleased to meet Muriel Deren from Danone on my way this morning here, because she did this study. I should have put her name here. So what do we see here? First, we see that if we compare healthy individuals and UC patients, here healthy individuals are family controls, we see first that if we look at the gene number or richness of microbiota in healthy individuals, it's higher than in patients. That actually has been noticed previously. There's quite a variability in gene number of patients. And when we look at the relapse frequency, that is severity of the disease, over past period, comparing patients which have lowest gene number and highest gene number, we see that the severity, that is number of relapses a year, is much higher in patients that have low gene number. So I went and did a longitudinal study, taking these patients here at the baseline. About half of them have relapsed over a year period that we follow them. There's a tremendous loss of diversity, or of richness rather, at that time, but patients which did not relapse have no significant difference. Actually, we can detect impending relapse by following loss of richness. These guys who have not relapsed during the follow-up period seem to be on their way to relapse, although this is not significant, but the trend is there. Another example is liver cirrhosis, where we found lots of metagenomic species which were enriched in liver cirrhosis patients. Here are healthy individuals and liver cirrhosis patients. This is discovery cohort, 181 individuals. You can see that these species tend to be present in the patients. And these species tend to be enriched in healthy individuals, that is lost in patients. Similar pattern is observed in the validation cohort. Now, if you look at the severity of the disease, there are two scores that can be used to evaluate severity of the liver cirrhosis. For both of them, when we compare a quartile of people who have the lowest load of species that are enriched in liver cirrhosis with those that have a highest load, we see that the severity of people with highest load is much higher, very significantly higher. Actually, the perturbation of gut communities in liver cirrhosis are tremendous. There's a huge loss of richness in discovery and validation control. The species that we see enriched, which are rare in healthy individuals, can represent up to 40% in extreme patients when they're basically absent in healthy control. We did found two individuals which have considerable amount of these species. I think this should be controlled, actually, for liver cirrhosis. Interestingly, most of the species, 24 out of 28, we know what they are. We have sequence of the genomes, and they can be not only used for diagnostics, but also possibly as targets for intervention. Beyond diagnostic and following the patients, we can also try to see whether we can predict risk of developing a chronic disease. We have published a couple of papers last year in Nature, where basically in the first one, we describe population of individuals which have actually, it's a bimodal distribution of gene richness across this population of almost 300 Danes. Some people have low bacterial richness, some have high bacterial richness. They have different enterotypes, which are presented here. Low gene count individual, low richness individuals belong mostly 80% to bacteroides enterotype, while high richness people belong to ruminococcus enterotype. They have very different bias distribution of at least 10 known species. You can see that these species are more abundant in people with low gene number, and these species are abundant in people who have high gene number. The same thing for many more unknown metagenomic species. And most interestingly, low gene count, low bacterial richness, which is one out of four. People have less healthy metabolic and inflammatory traits, which is illustrated here. They have increased adiposity, insulin resistance, dyslipidemia, inflammation, and that clinicians tell us is a predisposition for type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, some hepatic diseases. So we can detect individuals by these means who are at high risk of developing chronic disease. Not only these guys have a high risk, they have also, if obese, put on much more weight over past 9 years when they have low richness than when they have high richness. We have detected 8 different metagenomic species which, when at low level or absent, people pick up lots of weight. What are these species? Actually, we don't know that well, because except for one, Metanobrevibacter smithii, these species don't have closely related reference genomes. But we wonder whether they have a protective role. And when we look at higher taxonomic levels, we can assign them to taxonomies, phyla, which are known to be butyrate producers. And thus, we wonder whether we could re-implement perhaps these guys and therefore combat weight gain, a kind of new type of probiotics that one can think about. Do we see these perturbations only in Danes? No, we looked also in French, and we detect similar kind of distribution, bimodal distribution, this biased presence of MGS. Here in this smaller cohort, 49 people, we found 18 MGS, which were significantly different. 14 out of 18 were also found in Danes. And when we constructed algorithms to find who is high and who is low gene count individual, we can do that with the AUCs, which are about 0.95. The very same algorithm works for, which was trained on French, works with Danes. So we can identify these people who are at higher risk with 95% accuracy. We, of course, don't know what causes the loss of richness. Antibiotics were invoked as a possible causes, but to try to go further, we explored twins. Actually, I have to put now twin cohort from King's College London, because I'm there. But actually, we studied that in Holland. What did we find with healthy Dutch twins and their spouses? About 240. We see this distribution, which is not as clearly bimodal, but there is a shoulder. If you look at our 6 discriminant MGS that give such high AUCs, we see that their distribution is also very biased. We get an AUC which is almost as high as with French and Danes. I remind you that the algorithm was trained strictly on French, and we do see that bioclinical parameters are similar. So once again, we identify these guys in this cohort as being at higher risk. And we find that multiple factors can affect gene richness. When we compare gene richness of twins, we see a reasonably high correlation, which indicates that it may be genetics and environment as control. If you compare random individuals, of course, there is no correlation. One wouldn't expect it. Interestingly, when we compare spouses, we start seeing some correlation, which indicates that perhaps there is a possibility of sharing and altering microbiome. Age seemed to be a factor. Smoking seemed to be a factor. There may be a number of these things which we are still working on, trying to define what impacts the richness, which seems to be such an important parameter. Just to illustrate that it's not only in Europe that we find that perturbation, here we compared actually MGS which are associated to richness and that we have identified in a cohort of healthy Chinese controls for our liver cirrhosis study with distribution of this MGS in Danes. And by and large, you can see here that individuals are ordered by their gene number, that these profiles are quite similar. Actually, about 80% of MGS which are associated with richness in Chinese are associated in the same richness in Danes, which tells us that there are facets of gut microbiome over continents that are similar, and that we should be able to identify people at risk by their richness over, well, maybe humanity. To wrap up this part, this is a meta-analysis with almost 1,600 individuals, where we compared gene counts in healthy individuals and patients. This is our threshold for low gene count and high gene count individuals. We see that among healthy individuals, the guys here have about 600,000 genes. I'll come back to these two cohorts, one from the United States, the other from China. When we go to patients, by and large, chronic diseases are accompanied with loss of richness, except for type 1 diabetes, which seems to be an interesting exception when we see that richness is comparable to that of healthy individuals, but the numbers are still small, so the jury is still out there. But it may be that there are different diseases which where this rule will not work. Now, how about these two cohorts? These guys have as low richness as our Crohn's disease, IBD disease patients, even lower. So how come? Well, we wonder whether it's not due to the differences of analytical approach. Consistently, all cohorts were analyzed by the MetaHit pipeline, except this two. Now, if you look at quantitative metagenomics, there are really two parts of it. One is DNA sequencing and bioinformatics, and we think that was reasonably well standardized among the cohorts, but the other part is pre-analytical sample collection processing, and that was different across the studies. So we just wonder whether maybe this apparent loss of richness is not real, and we think that actual standardization in microbiome studies is quite critical. Okay, so we can detect the risk, but can we act upon it? That's the other facet of prevention. We think about microbiome perturbation as an ecological disease rather than a pathogen infection invasion, and wonder how to modulate microbiome. I think I'll show you here just one example from the MicroBees study, which was a nutritional intervention carried out in France on 49 overweight and obese individuals. I have shown you microbiome of these individuals at baseline earlier in my talk. These individuals followed a calorie-restricted diet for 6 weeks and then maintenance diet for 6 weeks in MicroBees project coordinated by my colleague and friend Joël Doré. The study was done under responsibility of Karine Clément from PTS Salpêtrière. Dietary intervention was a diet which was high in protein, low in fat, and have low glycemic index carbohydrates, supplemented with some fibers, and you can find more about that in this publication. The most striking result of the study was that low gene count, low gene richness individuals recovered a substantial part of their richness over the dietary intervention in parallel with improvement of bioclinical parameters. However, we did not succeed to correct fully the richness defect. This change was not significant with high gene richness individuals. However, high gene richness people did respond better in terms of their inflammatory parameter, which we couldn't correct as efficiently in the as in the hygiene count individuals. So, a message out of that is that low diversity microbiome appears to be less healthy. It can be diagnosed simply, and thus individuals at higher risk identified, and there are some interventions that can correct and possibly alleviate the risk, and we think that this could have a major impact on public health. We all know that chronic diseases are frequent and costly. In France, 4.4% of population suffers from type 2 diabetes, and the cost of this disease in France is about 12 billion euros a year. Here I am showing the deficit of social security, and it goes all the way to 12 billion euros a year. Then it's decreased, but you know, it fluctuates. We hope it will go down, but it doesn't actually. So we wonder whether these chronic diseases, could they be retarded by systematic analysis to detect the risk and treatment to alleviate the risk of microbiota? Just 1 year of retardation of type 2 diabetes could save untold billions, not to speak about human suffering. How to raise to that challenge? Well, French government actually is funding Metagenopolis project, which is a pre-industrial demonstrator. The funding is from the government is about 19 million euros until 2020. Budget is estimated to about 80 million euros. Metagenopolis has 4 platforms and clinical interface, has 3 partners, ICANN, which is headed by Karine Clément, and which is situated at PTSL Petrier Hospital, one of the largest hospitals in Europe. Another partner is Catholic University of Lyon, which helps with ethics and society questions. And the operational part is operated by INRA. It's 3 different platforms which have to do with sample biobanking, quantitative metagenomics that I have told you a lot about, and functional metagenomics, which I won't have really time to expand on. We are at Metagenopolis at cutting edge in metagenomics, having been associated and published a number of impactful papers there, and of course, well introduced in national and international communities. But that's not quite enough. Discoveries are nice, and it's always great to find new things, but one needs to impact the society also to engage industry. Thus, have started a couple of years ago now, Enteron, which has a mission to profile gut microbiome and manage thus microbiotal diseases, number of investors in there, and we expect to have a simple kit to assess richness of gut microbiome by the end of this year, which will position us really to be able to try to assess how important this loss is across the population. Remember, 1 out of 4, which is a lot. And also to see whether we can connect it to some interventions. And I think that following the injunctions of Philippe to speak, to be short when I speak. Yes, that's my phone, I'm so sorry. Time for me to stop. Yes. We think that the human microbiome has tremendous potential to impact public health, diagnostic, prognostics, patient monitoring, target for modulation to improve health, and most importantly, perhaps it could help us to shift what I think needs to be done, medicine, from mainly curative today to preventive tomorrow. Save resources, most importantly, human suffering. So what remains for me to say is acknowledge fantastic help from partners from MetaHit Consortium, great guys, MicroBees with Karin Clément, Jean-Daniel Zucker, who is here. Thank you, Jean-Daniel, for all the help. Joël, who coordinated that. People from MetaGenopolis. And I'll end just by thanking you for your attention and recommending to take good care of your microbiota so it's rich, as rich as this beautiful Kyoto garden, help you preserve your health. Thank you.